Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Hernandez against Shannon. Mr. Pages.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Donald Pekus. I represent the defendant appellant, Sheriff Michael Sheehan. If the judgment entered in this case is affirmed, jailers will be required to act as appellate courts, reviewing and questioning all commitment orders and detention orders that they receive. Moreover, jailers will be exposed to unprecedented liability any time they are holding an individual who protests their innocence and is later found that that individual is exonerated.
Is it your position that under no circumstances does a jailer have the responsibility to inquire as to the identity of someone he's holding?
That is correct. Not when they are in possession of a commitment order. What happened in this case, Mr. Hernandez protested a misidentification on the first day that he was in the jail.
Well, the commitment order pertaining to whom is I recognize your position is that it's clear that this commitment order concerned this person. But what happens if the judge says in open court, take that man into custody, points to somebody, and the deputy sheriffs grab the person standing next to him and haul him away, and he says, I'm not the person the judge told you to hold?
Judge, there is a procedure that's followed it's ensured that the order that and the individual who the judge is directing the order to is the one that's in custody. There are numbers written on everyone's hand.
So your answer to Judge Ripple is that jailers and sheriffs can indeed be liable if they take into custody a person other than the one the judge told them to hold.
I suppose that would be the answer. But
and then the question is, here is, who did the judge tell them to hold? Is it this, the judge tell them to hold this plaintiff particularly, or did it tell them to hold a person any person who happens to be a particular name?
It told him to hold the body that was in front of the court, and to ensure that's done, numbers are written on the hands of the individual, and the corresponding number is written on the commitment order. So this is not a misidentification by the sheriff. The sheriff was holding the person he was ordered to hold.
Has the Supreme Court ever gone as far as you're urging us to go, to say there's absolutely no obligation?
I don't believe the Supreme Court has, but certainly this court has, in the Aaronsman case, the Henry case, not directly on point, but it did state that orders that a sheriff executing an order does not have to review those orders, does not have to act as an appellate court.
But the problem is, in those cases, I mean, my concern is very much like that of my two colleagues. There must be some outer level of obviousness of mistake that would oblige the sheriff to make sure he has the right person. For example, if the individual standing next to that man was a woman and the court order says, take Enrique Hernandez, or Emiliano for that matter, and it's really Maria, I mean, is the sheriff allowed to lock her up and say, well, I have a court order? Surely no.
Well, the sheriff brought Mr. Hernandez.
You're
back
talking
to court.
About your case, but you're arguing for a very broad rule of law, and I think what we need to know is whether that rule of law is the correct rule, or whether some other circumstance about this case perhaps means that the sheriff behaved reasonably here, but not because the sheriff is entitled to simply put blinders on and toss into the clink whoever shows up.
Well, I submit that it should not be a reasonableness standard.
So it's okay to lock up Maria, too, even though the arrest was for Enrique.
Well, I suppose you can get to some point, some hypothetical, where it would be possible, where it's a complete and utter disregard, where the criminal defendant is not taken into custody, but his attorney is.
What if it had been a 6'3", 275-pound African-American man?
Well, the procedure is to return that person to court.
Well, I understand. Well, so you
or not, right?
Or not.
If you don't do that, then the question we're asking is, under what circumstances does the plaintiff have a claim?
Well, he has his
I mean, surely you would say that if what the sheriff's deputy did in order to make sure he had the guy the judge named was put in the prison, everybody who was in the courtroom at the time, that a large number of people would be in prison illegally, and they would be entitled to complain, would they not?
They would, absolutely.
Right? Well, then it's just a matter of detail, whether it's everybody in the courtroom or the judge told you to take A and you took B. Now, I think you ought to narrow your argument to the proposition that the sheriff was holding, with certainty, the person the judge said take into custody. Because that's the core of your argument in this case, as opposed to your more general argument.
That is the core of the argument in this case, absolutely. That
the police may have arrested the wrong man, but the sheriff was holding the person the judge identified.
Absolutely. And whether it's the police who made a mistake, whether it's the criminal defense counsel who let the plaintiff down, or whether it's the judge, it's clear, specifically in this case, that it was not the sheriff. The sheriff followed orders at all times, and this is not a warrant case. And
well, it was at the start. The police arrested the wrong person.
Right, but it's clear that even before the sheriff ever had custody of Mr. Hernandez, it was only pursuant to court order. At best, there was a warrant for one day. He came to court. He pled guilty on the driving without a license charge. He was sentenced to 2 days. He was then ordered to be brought to court. He was remanded into the sheriff's custody, and he was brought to court the following day. At that point, this is no longer a warrant case. This is an order. It's an order of commitment by the judge.
Well, and that's why I think it's important that the narrower version of your argument, I think, begins with the proposition that Mr. Emiliano Hernandez was, in fact, stopped and arrested by the Chicago police for doing something wrong, namely running a stop sign and driving without the required proof of insurance and with his driver's license. He's not contesting anything about that. It's when you get to that first hearing that you've appended to your brief, and we get to the point about the hold on the other claim. That's the moment at which things go awry, it seems to me.
Sure.
Because could they arrest him? Sure. Could they bring him in to answer for the other charges? Sure. He's not even complaining about that. And then it's at that point where the question is, you know, is it this man? There's nothing on this record that reflects who gets walked off to the prison or to the jail after that, but he's not contesting that he's the man who was walked off to the jail, right? So we also have a situation where from the middle of that first hearing before Judge O'Hara, it is in fact Mr. Emiliano Hernandez who shows up at the Cook County Jail on this additional charge.
Correct. And this is not, as I said, this was not a case of misidentification. Enrique
well,
Hernandez,
it is a case of misidentification by somebody because...
Correct, but not by the sheriff. This is not where Enrique was standing next to Emiliano and the sheriff got the wrong guy.
Right.
The order was clearly directed at Emiliano Hernandez, the order of commitment. As I said, this is not At that point, this is no longer a warrant case, but it is a regards a court order. And the Richmond case, Richmond versus Sheehan, teaches us that this, when the source of the wrong is the court order itself, which that is the case here, then the sheriff has absolute immunity.
No, well, I'm not sure about that, but because the first question anyway is whether there's actually a violation of the Constitution. I take it we've eliminated from this case all potential claims about the treatment that Emiliano Hernandez received in the jail. He mentions on page 19 of his brief, for example, that when he was trying to bring this problem to the deputy's attention, they used vulgar language and struck him.
That claim was not pursued.
Okay.
He would have certainly had that claim. He would have had claims as to the way the order was carried out, if he was denied medical care, if he was subjected to excessive force. Certainly those claims would still lie. But the detention itself, which was the only claim pursued...
That's where we're focused now.
...is where
right.
we are focused. If we don't follow this, we will...
Follow this what?
If we don't find that the sheriff is entitled to... entitled to absolute immunity, we could get some absurd...
You're not arguing immunity. You're arguing that the sheriff did not commit any substantive violation.
I'm arguing both.
I don't see what immunity has to do with this. I mean, we'll figure out whether there's a violation here. If there's a violation, we can ask whether it was clearly established or something like that. But your argument is that there's no violation of the Constitution when the sheriff carries out a judicial directive.
There's no due process and no violation.
That's not an immunity question. Immunity is interesting. Absolute immunity is interesting only when the public actor did violate the Constitution.
So, for example, when the state court judge said, "I think you're Enrique," right. He was acting in a judicial capacity, and the law says he's entitled to absolute immunity.
Yep.
It would have been pointless to have sued him for what he did.
I'm going to reserve my time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Longo.
May please the court, as Your Honor knows, my name is Mr. Joe Longo, and this is Mr. DeRose. As Your Honor's point, first of all, if I may say, in this country, nobody should have to feel as hopeless and helpless as Mr. Hernandez.
Counsel, could you slow down and speak up? I'm having a little trouble hearing
okay,
you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don't move the microphone. Okay. Just you can raise the podium if you want. There's a switch on the right side of the podium.
Inside.
That's okay.
I'll just would you like some help?
That's all right. I don't want to inconvenience anybody. In this country, nobody should have to feel as hopeless and helpless as Mr. Hernandez did and his wife and his family. Maybe in some other country,
hopeless
but not in
this country. Hopeless in what way? Was there any obstacle to his litigating during his appearances before the judge whether he was Enrique Hernandez?
Well, Your Honor, if we take a look at the first appearance, that was called in his name regarding traffic infractions, which were resolved. There was no mention, even though the sheriff mentions on page 30 and 31 of their brief that there was mention of a warrant, there's no mention of a warrant. What there is mention is legalese, there is a hold. There's no basis mention of the hold. There's no definition of a hold. Mr. Hernandez didn't even understand what a guilty and a non-guilty plea means.
Did he have a lawyer at the time?
He had a public defender.
Right.
But those traffic tickets were resolved, and the traffic court said, you can pay $500 to go home.
And the judge referred to him in what name?
Emiliano. In the first hearing.
In that first hearing, I mean, you get to the point where where Mr. Coleman says he has a hold, and the court says, on this charge you've served your time on, and then the court says you have to answer to the other charge that you were being held on. So there's that, and then there's the second hearing.
But that's the insurance. One could take it to
me. No, I understand. He might have thought that. But then at the next hearing, where the caption says, the people of the state of Illinois versus Enrique Hernandez, the clerk calls Enrique Hernandez, and the state's attorney says, does he have a hold? The court says some things. And there the question is, you know, it doesn't show that he had any lawyer with him then. But why didn't he speak up to the court and say, I'm not Enrique?
First of all, he was far away from the bench, and more important, just like this, just like in Armstrong, the deputy sheriff was behind him and told him to stand straight and shut up. So he's very respectful of authority and did as he was told. And neither of those hearings deal with probable cause or an identity hearing. And furthermore, at neither of those hearings did the court order the sheriff to take the plaintiff.
It's awfully hard to say that he was denied an opportunity when he never spoke to the court about this issue. I mean, suppose there had been a trial and he'd been convicted on the charge in this warrant. Would the sheriff still be entitled to listen to his claim? I mean, you remember the famous sequence in the movie The Fugitive, when Harrison Ford says to Tommy Lee Jones, the U.S. Marshal, I'm innocent. And Tommy Lee Jones says, I don't care. Of course, the reason he didn't care is he'd been convicted. Whether that was right or wrong, whether the judge was right or mistaken, you wouldn't expect the jailer or the U.S. Marshal to entertain a parade of alibi witnesses.
Of course not, because there was a trial. But here...
So why isn't the general principle that the sheriff is always entitled to accept the validity of an order issued by the court, whether or not the judge is mistaken?
Let's take a look at the order. Where does it say?
Don't talk about this order.
Okay.
The question is that a general principle?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The general principle, if there is a full hearing and there is an identity hearing, probable cause.
No.
Nothing
about full hearing. Whether there's a full hearing, one would think, is a question for the judge to decide on the request of the parties. The question I'm asking is, once the judge has made a decision and says to the sheriff, take that man into custody, if there's no question that the sheriff has got the man the judge is pointing to, is there any need for the sheriff to look behind the validity of the judge's order?
But don't we need more facts by that? I mean,
No, this is a legal question to which the answer is either yes or no. And you can answer it either way, and then tell me why.
Yes, because we have to look at the, what does the order say,
well,
keep him in jail
for
16 days?
Well, if you say yes, your
case is over. I mean, in the sense that, does the order say to keep him in jail for 16 days? The order said to let him pay $500 to go out on a bond, go home. It didn't say to keep him in jail overnight for the next court appearance. It didn't say to keep him in jail for 16 days. So what we have is a case in which the sheriff has a duty to have types of procedures to address repeated protests of misidentification, not only by him, but his wife, his other family members, and not just once, but repeatedly to different officers for 16 days.
But look, I mean, the real question here, I think, isn't whether mistakes were made in Mr. Hernandez's case. They obviously were. But the question is, first of all, who at root is responsible for these mistakes, and is there any legal remedy for that? Now, I am not particularly moved by the distinction the district court relied on between a claim of innocence and a claim of misidentification, because a great number of cases in the criminal defense system are defended on precisely the basis you have the wrong man. You know, there's an identity question, and that has to be resolved. The other thing that seems to me is that once that court order is there and the sheriff is told you must take person A into custody, it's you're almost arguing for the sheriff to be the one to file a motion for reconsideration with the court. The court doesn't want the sheriff second-guessing its orders. The court, you've agreed, is immune from from civil liability or anything else vis-a-vis this clear mix-up. We'll hear from the city, but the police officers argue that they had reason to think that this was just one of the many people who goes around with a couple of names. Sorry to say, it's not unknown. So, I mean, the question is, where exactly did things go wrong, and why is there legal liability?
I think there's legal liability because the crux is this, as this court is held in Patton, and the Baker court mentions, although it was a judicial immunity case, our case is not, because if sheriff is not sued as an individual, so Henry doesn't apply, is this. The sheriff admitted at trial they have no procedures to address misidentifications. In fact, when asked if an innocent person repeatedly protests, I've been misidentified, are there any procedures for the officers to go to supervisors? And the defendant testified, for the 25th time, we have no procedures.
But why isn't, I mean, I understood the sheriff to be making a slightly different, but importantly different answer to that question, which was, the procedures we rely on are those in the court. You know, when we take people to court, they have an opportunity to say, I'm not the right person. And sadly, it took longer than it should have in Mr. Hernandez's case to sort it out. But
wouldn't that wipe out the case law that says that when a sheriff is repeatedly confronted with protests, and we have legal documents from the United States government and the Mexican government with fingerprints and photographs establishing that this is not Enrique? I mean, wouldn't the sheriff have some type of procedure to address?
No, it does not follow from the fact that the government has to give somebody a hearing, that every government employee has to give somebody a hearing all the time. And the question is there a right time and place for that? And if so, what is the right time and where is the right place? The right time may be in court rather than in the prison cell.
And maybe that would be a procedure that the sheriff would institute, but they don't even have that procedure.
Sheriffs don't institute procedures to be held in court. They're instituted by states. I mean, that drives me back to my question. Was there anything impeding Hernandez's ability? Was there anything impeding Hernandez's ability to get a decision by the court? I mean, take Judge Wood's question. If after the second appearance in court and the express committal saying, hold this man on X dollars bond, his lawyer had filed a motion for reconsideration, would that have been thrown in the wastebasket or would it have been entertained?
I'm sure it would have been entertained. He did not have a lawyer, but the order certainly didn't call to keep him for 16 days. If anything, the sheriff violated the orders by not allowing to pay $500 to go home. And furthermore, there's no procedures to evaluate bonds and make sure that the right bond information is transcribed from court report or court documents. There's no procedures to check the work of subordinates. Any corporation would have supervisors.
Do you, by the way, have any comment about the bearing of the Supreme Court statement in Heck against Humphrey that following the initial judicial appearance, there is no liability for the sheriff, whether or not the judge was right?
I'm not familiar with that case, but it would seem to me we have to look at the substance of the first appearance, as the Griffin Court says.
Supreme Court said, if there's a false arrest claim, damages for that claim cover the time of detention up until issuance of process or arraignment, but not more. The Supreme Court is clearly saying that the person who's in charge of the arrest and holding is answerable for the time when the detention is on his own book. And after that, when the detention is authorized by a judge, there are no further damages against the detaining person.
Did the judge authorize the detention of 16 days here? And we could have, and the sheriff could have.
Look, we're getting two things mixed up. There are separate questions about whether the sheriff is entitled to carry out the judge's order, and then we have a question whether the sheriff carried it out properly, and if so, whether that's covered by immunity. It's clear mistakes were made in this case. We're trying to get at the underlying principle.
It's my understanding the argument of executing an order relates to judicial immunity if the sheriff was sued as an individual, and the sheriff was not in this case. But it was my understanding the crux is that the sheriff has to have procedures to address repeated pleas of misidentification. The sheriff admits they have no procedures.
But to what extent were you exploring more general issues of the procedures that the sheriff's office uses to ensure that people are released in a timely manner on bond? That happens, of course, all the time.
We explored those, and what we learned was that there are no procedures, number one.
But what's the error rate? I mean, does it mean that people sit around in the Cook County Jail for years because nobody bothers to check as whether they're due to be released?
We don't know the error rate, but we do know the Seventh Circuit is held in situations that call for procedures. The lack of procedures may rise to a constitutional concern.
Well, but if you don't know the error rate, how do you know that there are no procedures?
because they testify that there are no procedures to check work, for example, of subordinates to make sure the right bond information is being transcribed. And they have their own procedure on this whole document. It's an internal document that next to the word bond, if it's blank, the sheriff will prohibit bond despite what the court orders say. And we have three court orders that say Mr. Hernandez can pay $500, actually Enrique, to go home. And there are no procedures to check this. In fact, when an officer, there are no procedures to make sure that officers use the correct name when they're filling out booking documents. So there's no way to hold people accountable. And that would be deliberate indifference. In fact, the defendant testified that he has seen officers' names on documents which they supposedly completed when they were on vacation. How do you hold somebody accountable? I mean, isn't that sloppiness, with all due respect? Doesn't that contribute to deliberate indifference? Don't you need procedures to check that and make sure that you have the right people in jail?
Judge Wood raised a very interesting question.
I'm sorry?
What the Supreme Court said in Matthews against Eldridge is that what the Constitution demands depends in part, maybe in substantial part, on the error rate from particular proceedings. Don't we need to know what the judicial error rate is to know whether some alternative or additional procedure is required?
But doesn't that beg the question when you say additional procedure?
I'm asking a legal question about the meaning of a decision of the Supreme Court. What do you think Matthews against Eldridge tells us about that issue?
And, Your Honor, additional procedure to me implies there are procedures, and there are none here.
But here's the point, though. If, in fact, the error rate were one-third, that would certainly indicate, I'm using a big number here just for the illustration, that more procedure was necessary. That would be a terrible error rate. If it's 0.01% of people who somehow slip through the cracks, that's a very tiny error rate, and you would say, in any system run by human beings, you really actually can't get it down to zero, so that's probably a system that's working pretty well, and it's quite unclear that additional procedures would work. This one's probably somewhere between, you know, that one-third and that 0.01%. But if we don't know where it is, we don't know whether the addition, as a constitutional matter of constitutionally compelled additional procedures, would be called for.
I believe we don't know what it is because the sheriff doesn't keep track of that error rate. If I remember correctly, I believe I asked those questions in the deposition, and they don't keep track of it. And maybe primarily because they don't hold...
The sheriff wouldn't. The court might. But in any event, you would. It's not a question you answer at depositions. It's a question you answer by having an expert do a statistical analysis of a substantial database.
I'm wondering... And I can understand that, but in the Armstrong case, the will call list, I mean, did this court look at statistics but rather look at something that is obvious and that procedure should be instituted for something that's obvious? Here, aren't misidentifications something that's somewhat obvious?
Well, but the problem I keep having with that essence of your claim is, you know, I think back to the number of cases I've seen where people go by numerous names, you know, Enrique, Emiliano, whatever, and courts are skeptical of somebody saying, oh, no, that's my evil brother. There are judicial determinations, which I'm sure this isn't the only case where it's been wrong. So the question is, at what point in the process do you expect the remedial measures to take place, whether it's the sheriff? I mean, I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that prohibits the sheriff. If a man keeps saying, you know, I'm really not the right guy, here is more and more evidence, maybe the sheriff would do something. But, of course, eventually something gets done here, not soon enough, ideally, but...
And in this case, may I ask, though, when we talk about a judicial determination, there is some type of hearing that's done, and maybe the sheriff would have a procedure to bring the person to court and say, well, this man is protesting. Here we have no procedure, none.
If you want any time to argue your cross-appeal, you will probably need to do it.
I appreciate that.
Your white light is on.
Oh, thank you so much for telling me.
You're not arguing your cross-appeal.
I think he misunderstood you.
Pardon?
I think he misunderstood.
I apologize. I thought you were telling me to.
This is your time.
I apologize. Regarding the city's argument, Your Honors, Mr. Hernandez testified in his deposition that on June 9th, he asked his wife, he called her up.
Would
and said,
you once again raise your voice, please?
Okay. On June 9th, Mr. Hernandez testified that he asked his wife to bring over his identification because he left his driver's license in his pants and other legal documents because they think I'm somebody else. Mrs. Hernandez went at 8 o'clock that night to the police station, and she went again at midnight with legal documentation. Now, in the deposition, the defendant asked ambiguous questions according to the Loyola University linguistics expert. And one of those questions is in the brief. The other question was, the defendant, the city, asked, at the time of the phone call, did Mr. Hernandez say anything about an arrest warrant for Enrique? She correctly answered no. And the reason is because during that phone call, Mr. Hernandez didn't know about an arrest warrant for Enrique. He just knew he was misidentifying. It would seem to me, Your Honors, that it's up to the jury to decide whether the affidavits are not consistent with the deposition. This is particularly true that the jury would take into account the fact that Mr. Hernandez testified that he called his wife and said to bring legal documentation, number one. Number two.
Put all of this affidavit business behind us. There can't be any liability against the city of Chicago other than for its policies. What reason do we have to think that the city of Chicago has a policy of arresting the innocent?
Well, Your Honor, the city, as Judge Grady found in initially denying summary judgment, the city did not have policies to address claims of misidentification.
Now, look, we're back to this special policy argument. There's no derivative liability for the city. Do we have any reason to think that the city of Chicago has a policy of arresting the innocent? Or equivalently, perhaps pursuing my colleague's question, that it arrests the innocent so often that it has to know that there's a serious problem that it needs to deal with?
I don't know if it's so much, and I understand what Your Honor is saying, but isn't the question is that when you do have an innocent person, you should have procedures to address it?
Look, is there any evidence in this record of mm-hmm. such a policy?
Of always arresting innocent people?
No, of either a policy of arresting the innocent or the city knowing that it arrests the innocent so often that it had better, if it wants to stop doing that, institute some other...
Respectfully, isn't that an obvious danger of misidentification?
Don't. We're not playing a game of can I turn the question around. I'm asking a question about whether in the record there's evidence of either a policy or knowledge of a very high misidentification rate. Is either one of those things in the record?
I'm not aware of a policy of the city arresting innocent people.
I don't care whether you're aware of a policy. I'm asking about what's in the record.
I don't believe it's in the record
Thank
that
you.
There's a policy of arresting innocent people. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Longo. Ms. Pastor.
May it please the court. Two Chicago police officers witnessed Mr. Emiliano Hernandez run a stop sign. When they pulled him over, they discovered that he was driving without a license, indeed that license had been suspended, or proof of insurance. At that moment, Mr. Emiliano Hernandez was properly subject to a custodial arrest. Subsequently, the officers learned of the outstanding warrant for an Enrique Hernandez with the same birth date and physical description as Mr. Emiliano Hernandez, and they mistakenly concluded that those two individuals were the same. Hernandez now claims that the Chicago police officers ignored his wife's efforts to prove that he was not Enrique, and that this lack of paying attention to her protests constituted a constitutional violation.
Well, and I think he's also arguing that the steps that the city apparently goes through routinely, such as checking the lead system and the various other things the officers did, were constitutionally inadequate. That is the city's policy, right? I mean, you've outlined in your brief that the city doesn't just sort of say, you look like a problem to us, we're taking you in. They check. But
absolutely, Your Honor.
But his point is that it's not a good enough system, that it's going to do what it did here and hold the wrong man.
Well, as a threshold matter, Your Honor, it seems to the city that the only claim that Mr. Hernandez is pressing at this point in the litigation has to do with this incident with his wife, bringing the IDs to the police station. Certainly that's all that's addressed in his brief. And the district court also, upon denying, in part, the city's motion for summary judgment, focused exclusively on that piece, the piece about the wife coming to the police station. So we do not believe that claim about the city's express policies is before this court. Nevertheless, of course,
Well, you've briefed it, actually.
Well, we did in the we absolutely did, Your Honor, and so to get to that.
Does the city know what its error rate is?
No, Your Honor, it's not in this record.
Isn't that very odd? I mean, plaintiff does have a burden in litigation, and I can understand it not being in the record, but the proposition that the city doesn't even know how often these forms of checking lead to errors is weird.
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, if you are making a lot of errors, in addition to the fact that cities shouldn't want to do that to their citizens, you're wasting a lot of police resources and effort and space in the lockups. And the proposition that the city doesn't know how often these forms of cross-checking result in errors suggests a considerable mismanagement problem.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not going to stand here as a representative of the city and say that nobody at the city knows, because I don't have that information. I do not know, and it's certainly not in this record. That someone in the police department
right.
may know.
So now the revised answer is the city may well know this, you just haven't tried to find out.
Not in the context of this case. We have not. So I apologize if my first answer was not complete. Returning to the incident with Ms. Simenthal, the city's first argument is that there's simply no evidence that this incident ever even took place in the way that Mr. Hernandez describes. And second, as this court has alluded to already this morning, even if Mr. Hernandez could show that this incident happened, there is no evidence that there have been any other similar instances such that there could be a policy claim under Monell against the city. At the summary judgment stage, a litigant may not create a factual dispute by submitting affidavits that contradict prior sworn testimony by that same witness.
Is the affiant here, is English her second language?
It is. In fact, I gather she has very little English.
Shouldn't that be considered in applying this rule? This rule is harsh enough when you have someone whose first language is English and is pretty astute at handling lawyers in a deposition. When you have somebody whose language first language is not English, or as you say, is very weak in English, this sounds like an awful lot of gotcha.
Well, Your Honor, the deposition was conducted through an interpreter. So,
it sometimes creates the problems, doesn't it?
It does. That's, however, the best system that we have. Witnesses often have to testify in court through the use of an interpreter.
I don't mean to cut you off if you want to talk more about that, but do you need it? I mean, what do you win this case on if we decide to just pretermit the affidavit problem?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Putting the affidavits aside, the city has at least two ways to win this case. The first is again, there's no evidence of a policy claim here. The only entity that's being sued is the city itself, and Hernandez has simply not made a policy claim. The express policies of the city regarding verifying that the person being held on a warrant is the person actually being held are certainly constitutional with this series of redundant checks. Hernandez appears to be pressing a practice or custom claim, yet he has produced no evidence of any other similar instance in which a family member or someone else came to a police station brandishing identifying documents and was turned away. And, of course, without that, even at one other instance, you certainly don't have evidence of a customer practice. And, of course, there's no evidence that a policymaker had any awareness of this situation. But, again, of course, there's another basis for the city to win, and that is that the city absolutely had probable cause to arrest and detain Mr. Hernandez for as long as they did.
Is there any evidence that the city police officers usually arrest for driving on a suspended license and lack of proof of insurance?
Well, Your Honor, not so much in this record. However, what there are other cases decided by this court in which a custodial arrest based on these exact violations was took place and was upheld as constitutional.
Simply on the theory that the police have the objective right to arrest in those situations, and that's the end of the story?
Certainly, and because under Atwater, any offense can be the basis of a custodial arrest as long as it is permitted by state law, which Illinois state law does here. And, of course, it only makes sense. The idea that a police officer is going to let someone who's driving on a suspended license drive away belies common sense. Every extra block he drives is a continuing violation. And so that's it only makes sense that at that point someone's going to be taken into custody. So that is yet another basis for the city to prevail on summary judgment that, in fact, there was no constitutional violation by the actions of the police officers in this case. There are no further questions. We ask that the judgment of the district court as to the city be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, counsel?
Briefly, Your Honor, in response to Judge Wood and Judge Ripple's question regarding Matthews versus Eldridge, there's very little, at best scant evidence that this what happened to Mr. Hernandez occurs regularly at the Cook County Department of Corrections. The only testimony was that of Sister Rosemary, who testified in her 25 years of experience, 10 to 15 individuals have approached her and told her they are the wrong person. However, it was very generalized evidence.
Has the sheriff conducted a statistical analysis?
I know there's no statistical analysis. However, there's over 100,000 individuals pass through the door every year, and the only evidence that was in the record was the testimony of Sister Rosemary. Again, generalized evidence. We don't know the circumstances of any of those.
You'd think the court system would have good records of charges dismissed for misidentification. And then the sheriff would be able to figure out, by looking backwards of that, how probable, you know, how many of these there are.
Well, there is, in the age of computerization, I can say that it has diminished greatly. There is a problem desk. The evidence showed that there was a problem desk. There was one mistake that the sheriff made. We submit claim of regarding the no bond was waived. However, it's clear, and the evidence showed, that it was mere negligence that clerk entered the wrong put the wrong entry in the bond form. However, there was a procedure to fix the mistake. There is a problem desk. Mr. Hernandez approached the social worker, Sister Rosemary. She investigated, corrected the problem, and Mr. Hernandez was able to post bond. I ask that the judgment be reversed. It's a matter of sound public policy, and I submit that there is no better policy than having jailers follow orders of commitment from courts, and I thank you.
Thank you very much to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will take a brief recess before calling the second case.